Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Hello and welcome to the deep dive. You know, if your typical morning routine involves like three rounds of yelling, maybe a tearful negotiation over brushing teeth, and you walk away feeling like you kind of failed Parent 101, well, this dive is definitely for you. Today, we are cracking open a real classic, How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk, by Adele Faber and Elaine Maslisch.
Yeah, it's one of those books, isn't it? Its influence, I mean, it just keeps going. It hasn't faded because it really tackles the core issue in so many families that break down in communication.
Right.
The kind that leads to constant conflict, you know, power struggles and just mutual frustration, really. Feeling like you're talking past each other.
Okay, so let's unpack this then. Our mission here is to really distill the practical skills this book offers. It's not just theory. It's like a manual for a pretty fundamental shift.
Absolutely.
Moving away from maybe demanding blind obedience through control and more towards fostering real cooperation through connection. Think of it as a shortcut to mastering communication that actually builds a healthier relationship.
And the authors, Adele Faber and Elaine Maslisch, they have this really unique backstory that gives them credibility. They weren't, you know, academics in an ivory tower.
No.
They were mothers themselves. And they were open about struggling with the usual ways of doing things, the traditional discipline methods. And crucially, they were direct students of Dr. Haim Janot.
Yes.
The renowned child psychologist who really pioneered this whole emphasis on respectful, compassionate communication.
And that mentorship is so key, but I think what makes their work really hit home is how practical it is. Like you said, they weren't just taking theory.
Huh?
They spent over a decade running parenting workshops.
Mm-hmm. Real-world testing.
Exactly. Refining every single technique through, you know, trial and error with thousands of actual parents. So they kind of position themselves as peers, just sharing what worked, not as these distant experts telling you the right way.
That's spot on. They basically translated pretty complex psychological ideas, the why behind behavior, into these really actionable strategies, the how of communication, stuff any parent, you know, tired, busy, overwhelmed, can actually start using right away.
Right.
And it's that mix, I think, the deep psychological understanding plus the rigorously tested practical advice.
Right.
That's what gives the book its lasting power.
So at its heart, the book is really a practical manual. It's for anyone feeling stuck in that that frustrating cycle of nagging, maybe yelling, threats, punishing.
Negative loop.
Yeah, exactly. It genuinely offers a way out.
And the central idea is quite challenging, actually. It argues that many traditional methods, you know, commands, threats, and especially dismissing how a child feels, they actually damage self-esteem.
Right. They undermine the trust.
They undermine the trust in the parent-child bond. The author suggests that a lot of what we label misbehavior is often just a kid's reaction to feeling completely unheard or, you know, constantly controlled.
That makes sense.
Huh.
And the journey the book takes you on kind of mirrors that learning process. It's very systematic. It starts with looking inward, right? Self-reflection, making you aware of your own maybe knee-jerk, ineffective reactions. And then it moves straight into acquiring new skills.
Yeah.
How to handle big emotions, how to actually get cooperation, finding constructive alternatives to punishment.
Yeah.
It feels really empowering because it frames parenting not as some instinct you either have or don't, but as a learnable skill set.
That's a great way to put it, a learnable skill set.
So let's dive into the skills. The foundation, really, and maybe the most transformative piece, is chapter one, helping children deal with their feelings. The core idea here is huge. Kids literally cannot think or behave reasonably until their feelings are acknowledged. If you skip this step, you're just hitting a wall.
Absolutely. You have to deal with the emotion first. The book gives us four specific skills, the do's, that replace our usual instincts, like denying feelings.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're fine. It's not that bad.
Or jumping straight to advice. Just ignore him.
Exactly. Or giving philosophical advice. Well, life isn't fair. Those don't help in the moment.
Okay, so what are the skills? The first three seem crucial. One, listen with full attention. Like, actually put down your phone, turn towards them.
Show you're present.
Two, acknowledge with a simple word, just an ooh or or I see. It shows you're listening without judging.
Yeah, non-committal but present.
And three, give the feeling a name. Like, that sounds incredibly frustrating, or wow, you seem so disappointed. This actually helps them build their own emotional vocabulary, right?
Exactly. It validates and teaches simultaneously. And the fourth skill, This one's interesting. It's for those times when they want something they just absolutely cannot have.
The inevitable meltdown triggers.
Right. Grant their wish in fantasy. So if they're losing it over some super expensive toy in the store, instead of just saying, no way, you say something like, gosh, I wish I had $1 million. I'd buy you all the toys in this store. We'd get 10 of those giant trucks.
Okay, that sounds nice in theory, but I mean, won't they just learn to manipulate me to get that fantasy wish? Or won't it make the eventual no even harder when reality bites?
That's a really common concern. But the authors are clear. Validating the feeling or the desire is not the same as agreeing to the action.
Okay.
When you grant the wish in fantasy, you're basically saying, wow, I hear how much you want that. I get it. You're connecting with the desire. You're not saying, okay, let's buy it.
So you connect first.
You connect first. And often, once that deep desire feels heard and respected, the child actually calms down enough to accept the reality of no. It's kind of like an emotional shortcut past the meltdown, getting them back to a place where they can hear reason.
I see. Okay, so we've maybe calmed the storm with the fantasy wish or just by listening. But the mess is still there. You know, the backpack's still not packed, the dog still needs walking. How do we pivot from validating feelings to actually getting things done, getting cooperation?
That's the perfect next step. This is where we stop ordering, stop commanding, and start inviting cooperation. So instead of the classic, why haven't you taken the trash out yet? Are you lazy? Which, let's be honest, just guarantees a fight.
Oh, yeah. Defensiveness immediately.
Right. You pivot to describing the problem non-judgmentally.
Okay, give me an example. Like, wet towel on the bed again. Instead of yelling.
Instead of get this wet towel off the bed now, you just describe the problem. There's a wet towel on the bed. Or even just say it with one word, towel. Sometimes that's enough.
Okay.
Or, and this is powerful, use an I statement. Describe what you feel without blaming them. I don't like seeing my brand new saw left out in the rain because I'm worried it'll get rusty.
Okay. So you attack the problem, the rust, the wet bed, not the person.
Exactly. You're attacking the problem, not the child's character. And that instantly changes the whole dynamic, doesn't it? It goes from being you versus me to more like us versus the rusty saw or us versus the wet bed.
Yeah, it makes it collaborative instead of confrontational. Okay, so that leads really nicely into the next big area, which is alternatives to punishment. This challenges that really deep-seated belief many of us have that kids have to suffer somehow to learn their lesson.
Right. The book argues that punishment often just distracts the child. They stop thinking about what they did wrong and start focusing entirely on anger or resentment or maybe plotting revenge.
Or just how unfair it is.
Or how unfair it is. True discipline, the authors say, should teach. It should aim for future responsibility. So let's say a child draws on the wall instead of yelling and sending them to their room in disgrace.
Which teaches them.
Exactly. Instead, you express strong disapproval without attacking character. Whoa, I do not like that. Walls are not for drawing on. You're firm. You state the boundary clearly.
Okay, separating the action from their identity. You did something unacceptable, not you are unacceptable.
Precisely. Then step two, show how to make amends, not by just dictating a punishment, but by focusing on fixing the problem. What this wall needs now is a good washing. And then you involve them in the cleanup. They learn cause and effect directly.
Makes sense. And the other alternative.
Offer a choice. This preserves their sense of autonomy, which is huge for cooperation. You can bang on your drum pad in your room, or we need to put the drums away for now. What works for you? Or with homework. You can do your homework now before your show, or you can do it right after dinner. You decide. They still have to do it, but they have some control. They learn accountability through making choices.
Okay, moving on. Building self-worth. Chapter 5 talks about praise. Now, we're generally taught praise is good, right? Positive reinforcement. You're such a smart boy. What a beautiful drawing. But the authors have a caution here. They say that kind of conventional evaluative praise can actually be counterproductive.
Yeah, it sounds counterintuitive, doesn't it? But think about it. If you're constantly told you're so smart, what happens when you struggle with something?
You feel like a fraud. Or maybe you avoid challenges so you don't risk not looking smart.
Exactly. That kind of evaluative praise creates dependence on external validation. The child starts working for the label good artist, smart kid, rather than for internal satisfaction. It can create anxiety, this pressure to always live up to the label. It kind of puts them in a
So
box.
what's the alternative then? If we don't say good job.
It's descriptive praise. Instead of evaluating, you just describe what you see. Concrete details.
Okay, like.
Wow, I see a clean floor. The books were all back on the shelf.
Yeah.
And look, the caps are back on all the markers.
You're just stating the facts.
You're stating the facts. And then you can also describe what you feel as a result. It feels so peaceful walking into this room when it looks like this, or it's such a pleasure.
I get it. So you let the child draw their own conclusion. Like, wow, I did make the room look good. I did put effort in. They get to praise themselves internally based on specifics.
Precisely. It builds self-esteem based on their actual effort and accomplishment, not just on needing your approval. It's more resilient.
Okay, and the final skill set area, chapter 6, is about freeing children from roles. This is subtle but important. We tend to unconsciously label our kids, don't we? He's the shy one. She's the messy one. He's the athlete.
Mm-hmm. And kids are incredibly perceptive. They pick up on these labels and often they start to live up to them or maybe even feel trapped by them.
So how do we break that cycle?
The book suggests actively looking for opportunities to show them a different picture of themselves. Find moments that contradict the label. So maybe to the child you usually think of as cautious, you say, you know, even though climbing can feel scary sometimes, you were really brave today when you decided to try that higher part of the climbing frame.
You're highlighting evidence against the old role.
Exactly. You're giving them concrete evidence of other parts of themselves. Another really effective tactic they mentioned.
This one's my favorite.
Yeah. It's great. Let children overhear you saying something positive about them. You're talking to your partner or maybe on the phone with grandparent, and you say within earshot, you know, he was so patient with his little sister this afternoon when she kept knocking over his blocks.
Oh, that indirect praise. It feels more genuine sometimes.
It often lands more powerfully, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That third-party validation helps them internalize that positive quality patience. In this case, maybe even more effectively than direct praise would.
Okay, so those are the core skills. But if we zoom out a bit, what are the big overarching themes or messages running through the whole book beyond just the specific techniques?
Well, one huge reframe, I think, is this shift in the parent's role.
Huh?
Moving from being the judge to being a facilitator.
What do you mean by that?
Instead of always being the one who decides who's right, who's wrong, what the punishment is, you facilitate the child's own process of figuring things out. You help them understand feelings, identify problems, brainstorm solutions, learn from consequences. You guide them toward developing their own internal moral compass rather than just relying on yours.
That makes sense. It builds their capability. And that links directly to another big theme. Respect is a two-way street. The book constantly nudges us, doesn't it? Treat your child with the same courtesy you'd offer an adult friend.
Mm-hmm.
You probably wouldn't bark orders at a friend or dismiss their sadness by saying, oh, get over it. It's not a big deal.
You wouldn't. And the book really emphasizes modeling that mutual dignity. It's not about abandoning authority, but about interacting respectfully within the relationship, moving away from a purely top-down hierarchy.
Which leads right into the idea of discipline as teaching, not punishment. This is a core distinction they make.
Absolutely. They're very clear. Punishment primarily focuses on making the child pay for a past mistake. And what that often breeds is just resentment or sneakiness.
Right. How to not get caught next time.
Exactly. Discipline, in their view, should be forward-looking. It's about teaching them the skills and understand they need to navigate similar situations better in the future. It builds responsibility, not just fear.
And the fourth theme that really stands out is just the incredible, almost surgical power and precision of language. Every single skill we've talked about hinges on choosing your words carefully.
It really does.
The difference between attacking someone's character like you're so disorganized versus just stating a clear, neutral observation, I've noticed your backpack is still unzipped and papers are falling out, that difference is profound in how it's received.
Absolutely. The words create the weather in the relationship.
The book is also full of these really memorable, almost quote-worthy ideas that sum things up.
It really is. One that captures that foundational emotional piece is basically, when kids feel right, they'll behave right. How do we help them feel right? By accepting their feelings.
That just completely reorders the usual approach, doesn't it? It's connection first, then correction. You have to, like, fill the emotional tank before you can expect the car to drive smoothly.
Mm-hmm. Then there's the one about praise, summing up that descriptive versus evaluative idea. Describe, don't evaluate. The moment you tell a child he's good or great, you've put him in a box.
Right. But when you describe the effort or the outcome, you give him a chance to evaluate himself and draw his own positive conclusions. It builds that genuine, internal, resilient self-esteem based on what they actually did, not just on needing your stamp of approval.
Exactly. And maybe the most resonant one, the one that really speaks to the long-term impact we have.
The inner voice one.
Yeah. The way we talk to our children becomes their inner voice.
Oof. That lands heavily, doesn't it? It just underscores the sheer weight and responsibility of our words. We are literally helping to shape their lifelong internal narrative, their self-talk, their sense of self-worth.
It's a powerful reminder.
Okay, so let's make this really practical for listeners. How can someone start applying these skills today? Let's take a common scenario. Sibling rivalry. The fighting. He started it.
Okay, classic situation. Instead of jumping in as the judge and trying to figure out the impossible who really started it, you shift to being a facilitator.
Right, like we talked about.
First, acknowledge each child's feelings separately and equally. No taking sides. Wow, you sound really angry because he took your favorite car. And you sound really frustrated because she won't share the blocks. Give voice to both perspectives.
Okay, validation for both. Then what?
Then state the family rule or boundary clearly. Okay. But hitting is not okay in our family. Then you put the problem back to them to solve with your guidance. We have a problem here. Two kids, one car. What can we do to solve this so it feels fair to both of you? You empower them to find a solution together.
I like that. Shifting the onus onto them. Okay, what about another common one? Homework stress. The kid throws down the pencil. I hate this. It's too hard. I can't do it.
Yeah, the immediate instinct is often to lecture. Right? You didn't even try or just focus.
Totally.
Instead, you start by showing respect for the struggle. Use that acknowledging skill. Wow, that math problem looks really complicated. I can see why you're feeling so frustrated right now. Connect with the feeling first.
Validate the struggle.
Then gently encourage their autonomy and problem solving. Maybe ask, what have you tried so far? Or, that's a tough one. What do you think the very next small step might be? Or even, do you want to brainstorm some possible approaches together? You're a coach, not just a taskmaster.
And it's worth mentioning again, isn't it, that these skills aren't just for kids.
Oh, absolutely not. That's maybe the most profound realization. These are fundamentally human communication skills. They work because they're based on respect and validation.
So you could use I statements in a tricky conversation with your partner.
Definitely. I feel worried when the credit card bill is higher than expected, instead of, you spent too much money again.
Or use descriptive praise with a colleague at work. I really appreciated how you clearly outlined the project steps in that meeting instead of just, good job.
Exactly. It makes all our relationships, adult ones included, more respectful and effective.
So wrapping up, I think this book really offers this sense of empowerment. It demystifies why we get stuck in those negative cycles and shows that building a really deep cooperative relationship isn't magic. It's the direct result of learning and practicing a specific set of communication skills. We can consciously choose to replace those knee-jerk, often ineffective reactions with words and approaches that actually build connection and competence in our kids.
Yeah, I agree. For me, the most lasting takeaway is that fundamental shift in perspective. You stop seeing parenting primarily as a battle for control, which is exhausting and often counterproductive.
Right.
And you start seeing it more as this process of guiding and nurturing a capable, emotionally intelligent, and ultimately autonomous human being. And the key insight is that by focusing first on connection, on validating feelings, on respect, you actually create the very conditions needed for cooperation and responsibility to grow naturally. You build the relationship, and the good behavior tends to follow.
Connection before correction.
Connection before correction. That's the heart of it.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.